boy, I'm really, really excited to bring this to you now. This book will change your life, literally. If you have a young person that plays sports in your life, and you give the sports gene a try, David Epstein, ladies and gentlemen, who has hit it out of the park with this, it's now out in paperback, New York Times bestseller, and now joins us on the program. And David, first of all, congratulations on the sports gene. It's so thought-provoking.
Thanks. I really appreciate that. It's kind of, I guess, the dirty secret of the book is it's like 12 or 15 of my own deepest questions about athleticism. I've been pleased to find out I wasn't the only person wondering.
As an overview of this book, because people will read the title, I know the book took off. It came out late summer, early fall of 2013, and it took off. People see the title, though, David, and they probably think, well, this is a real scientific look. And is there such a thing as a sports gene? And let's just start there. Is there such a thing as a sports gene?
Well, there are sports genes. There's not a sort of a single gene that makes someone just a good athlete all around. I mean, I was using that sort of in a metaphorical sense, like we talk about, you know, the music gene, someone having sort of traits that gives them high potential. And we've now identified sports genes, plural, and particularly in some cases, those that make people, one athlete, better able to adapt to a certain training regimen so that they progress in their skill development much more quickly than others do. And it's kind of a new concept that's emerged out of exercise genetics, this idea of trainability, maybe the most important form of talent of all. And it kind of renders obsolete some of our previous notions of talent that were this idea of something that just exists before you've had a chance to.
One of the aspects of this book that I love, you do what I do, you kind of try to distill it down, as you know, and you've been on my side of the aisle in terms of conducting interviews. But when I'm talking to someone like you that's amassed something this fascinating, you literally don't know where to start. I mean, there's just so much here. I know it started as an article for Sports Illustrated. Is this one of these things when you dug in that it just sort of wrote itself? Because that's what it seems like here. There's just so much here.
You know, it's funny that you say that. I mean, in a way, the ideas sort of flowed from one another pretty easily in some ways, because it really came out of my own questions, the things that I had either experienced as an athlete or seen. For example, I get into kind of Jamaican sprinters, and that's because I grew up in an area with a large Jamaican immigrant population, and we had these amazing sprinters. And when I realized there were 2.5 million people on that island, I wondered what the heck's going on there that they're producing all these great sprinters. And I became a longer distance runner in college, and now I'm running against Kenyan guys. And I'm starting to meet them and learn that they're all from the same one tiny town in the rural Western Rift Valley. And again, I'm like, what's going on in this place? Same time I'm training and getting more different, not more the same, from my own training group. You know, that and seeing things on TV like the ability of softball pitchers to strike out Major League Baseball hitters. And so I just sort of compiled all these questions in my head that stuck there. That first article for Sports Illustrated was basically me pitching to my editors a story on sort of the nature and nurture of sports performance so that I could go off and just investigate some of these questions that I had started compiling in my head for a long time. So sadly, it didn't write itself, but the questions certainly were these things that sort of flowed very naturally from my own experiences and interests.
And I think anybody that's interested in sports always will look at athletes and go, are they born or are they made? And unless I'm wrong, your book sort of makes the point that it's a combination, but where the combination lies is really the question, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the nature or nurture, of course, is an easy way to frame it, but for scientists, that's really not good enough, right? They need to know, well, in each specific case, in this sport or in this athlete, how are nature and nurture at play? There's no exact blanket answer for every skill or for every individual. The takeaway that I had after doing all the research for the book was that, well, it turns out that some of these qualities of elite athletes that I would have thought were innate or genetic, like the reflexes it takes to hit a major league fastball, turn out actually to be completely learned. And some of the other things that I would have thought would be like totally voluntary, just acts of will, like the compulsive drive to train, turn out to have these really important genetic components. So it turns out to be kind of nature and nurture often at work in counterintuitive ways.
David Epstein joining The Sports Gene. You've got to check this out. It's now out in paperback from Current, and trust me, you will not be able to put this thing down. Let's start here when we start looking at what's in your book, because it's just got so much. But I want to start at the afterword, because the afterword's an interesting place to begin after reading the book. in that you talk about the reaction that your book got, particularly you're taking on something we've seen in pop culture for years, the 10,000-hour rule.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a musician, and I play a lot of guitar and mandolins, stringed instruments, and I've always heard 10,000, if you just put in 10,000 purposeful hours, you'll get there. 10,000. And you say that's really a myth.
Completely. I mean, forget what I say. The psychologist Anders Ericsson, the researcher of Florida State, who did the work, says it's a myth, that it's been completely misconstrued. In fact, he's so dismayed at the media translation of his work that he has a letter linked on his faculty webpage at Florida State now, and the title of it is "The Danger of Delegating Education to Journalists," which is a pretty ominous title if I've ever heard one. Because that 10,000 hours, it was never a rule. It came from one small study of violinists where the top 10 had accumulated on average 10,000 hours of practice by the age of 20, not by any specific time, but by the age of 20. And most of them had, in fact, not reached 10,000 hours, but the average was skewed by a couple people who were way off the other end. But those people were so highly pre-screened when the study started, they had already gained admission to a world-famous music academy. This would be like claiming to do a study of what causes basketball skill, using only NBA centers as your subjects, noticing they'd all practiced a lot, and concluding, therefore, that only practice causes someone to become an NBA center, not practice plus being 7 feet tall. So it's what statisticians call a restriction of range problem. And that so-called 10,000-hour study suffered from it very badly, so it can't tell you what practice caused and what it didn't. And so it just got carried away. It just got completely carried away in pop culture. And the reason I felt like I had to address it is because it's causing this push towards sports specialization that we now know is the opposite of what you want to do to develop overall athleticism.
And talk about that, because I've got several people listening to me, and no offense to them. You know what I say? If that's what you feel like you need to do, God bless you, but you're spinning your wheels. If the hope is I'm going to take my son at the age of 8 and turn him into a robo baseball player or a robo quarterback, I say God bless you. The empirical scientific side of this says that's not the right way to go about it. I'd like you to expound on that.
That's right. So now it's pretty clear that the athletes who go on to become elite are actually practicing less early in life in their eventual sport. Not only are they practicing less, but they're doing so in a less structured way early in life than are the athletes who plateau at lower levels. Just to take one example of some research that's just brand new, just came out, looking at athletes at UCLA, people who reach the varsity level, you know, scholarship athletes at UCLA, on average specialized in a single sport at the age of 15.4. UCLA undergrads who had played sports but didn't make it to the intercollegiate level specialized at 14.2. And this is this trend that's showing up in every sport, in every study that's being done. Eventual elites spend their childhood doing what's called sampling. They try a variety of sports. They gain a variety of athletic skills during this period of brain flexibility, particularly before age 12. They also find sort of what fits their physiological talents and their psychology. And they don't focus in until the early or even mid, sometimes even late teen years. The typical pattern is a guy like Steve Nash, who plays a bunch of different sports, you know, went on to become two-time NBA MVP, didn't even own a basketball until he was 13 years old, clearly didn't hamper his skill development in any way. So everything is saying that this non-specialized, unstructured play, or what sports scientists will call implicit learning, where it's sort of kid-driven activity, and sports sampling through at least age 12, probably a little longer, is what elite athletes do in childhood. But the 10,000 hours idea is pushing in the exact opposite direction, toward early single sport hyper-specialization as early as possible, and it's not the way to get the best athletes.
And so what you're saying flies completely in the face of all these training academies that we see now. And, you know, proper training has its place, but you say proper training before a certain age actually will have a deleterious consequence in terms of developing if your goal is to be an elite athlete. Isn't that right?
That's right. If your goal is to be the best 8-year-old you can possibly be, then doing some of that hyper-structured training might help. If your goal is to be the best 18-year-old, it's not. And it misses, when we do that hyper-structured, sort of what's called explicit learning, where somebody's really telling you exactly what to do, early on, you miss taking advantage of this special period in life. So we all know that kids are these incredible learning sponges. And that implicit learning period is incredibly powerful, and kids should take advantage of that with unstructured, what scientists are now come up with a term called deliberate play that elite athletes undergo when they're young. And I think a great example of this, and the World Cup is going on, is what you see in Brazil. Here in the U.S., we have soccer academies for kids under six, you know, U6 traveling teams. If you go around Brazil, the kids aren't even playing soccer. They're playing a game called futsal, which is like a miniaturized form of street soccer. They play on tiny courts with a heavy ball, so it stays on the ground. It's like soccer in a phone booth, kind of. They're forced to sort of make all these decisions and to really work on decision-making skills and foot skills, and there's no structure to it whatsoever, and it's the game that, whether it's Lionel Messi or Cristiano Ronaldo, every guy who goes on to become an elite grew up on that sort of street ball form of soccer, not the kind of structured play that most of the Americans grew up with.
What's interesting is an observation. When I was a child, I'm 47. When I was a child, we played sun up to sundown. We played in parks. We played unstructured. Just as an observation, it seems like young people today, because everything is so structured, everything is so specialized, they don't play unless you put a uniform on them and unless there are officials present. That's a shame, isn't it? Because you really miss out on a lot of what sport is about when you only take sport as something that you do in front of your parents, in front of adults.
Definitely. I mean, I think even kind of the psychological and social aspects aside, now we know it also isn't the best for skill development. There are a lot of arguments for it. It's amazing how structured youth sports have gotten to the degree where there's just a 3-year study completed in Chicago that found that actually family income has now become a positive predictor of child athletes suffering serious overuse injuries, like stress fractures in the back and things like that, because only those families can afford to kind of pay for private coaching and year-round travel and all this stuff. Not a lot of health issues you see where having good family income is a negative for those. So it kind of shows how much we've perverted the child sports landscape.
In light of your book, in light of some of this empirical evidence, I do some work in the orthopedic industry, have met a ton of people. When I meet people in warm weather climates, one thing I like to ask them about is these overuse injuries. Mm-hmm. And I've literally had doctors tell me they've had to send kids, this is more than once now, this is two, send parents out of the room and ask the young person, okay, what's going on? And I had one guy tell me, he looked a kid in the eye and he said, son, I will put a cast on you if you want me to so that you don't pitch. We'll feint an injury here. That's going on. That is going on in our country.
All these torn ulnar collateral ligaments, you know, all the Tommy John surgeries this year, these high-profile Tommy John surgeries, those aren't happening at the major league level. Major league pitchers are pitching less at that level than they've ever pitched before. Those are injuries that stress the ligament, cause micro tears in the ligament, one outing at a time for years and years and years and years, and breaks down that ligament. Those are things that are set in motion in childhood, not that are happening at the pros. And now we're reaping what we sowed there. It's incredible. And to go back to your point about this kind of hyper-structured environment for youth athletes, there's a guy, a researcher in Canada named Jean Côté, who has all this really interesting data showing that because now cities that have lots of resources to structure sports play and have sort of coaches with technical expertise do this hyper-structured stuff in youth, now this huge overrepresentation of pro athletes are coming from really small cities, like cities the size of 50,000 to 100,000 in every single sport, because those are the places where hyper-structured sports leagues haven't reached as much yet. So in cities, the odds of a kid born in a larger city now making it to the elite level have plummeted, absolutely plummeted.
I don't know if people will hear us and get the message. Have you found a lot of resistance? I know in your afterword, you talked about the resistance from the 10,000-hour folks who want to adhere to that. Have you found resistance from this specialization culture? Has any blowback gotten to you yet? Because here's what the specialization culture is, David. We talked before we started recording today. Specialization culture is about money. It's about money.
I haven't gotten so much blowback on the specialization issue. Partly that's probably because that afterword that I added is sort of newish. So I haven't gotten any blowback yet. But I certainly have with respect to the 10,000 hours. I think some people glommed onto that idea and became so fervent about it that when I sort of showed where it actually came from, maybe they felt a little challenged by that, or they took it to mean that long periods of hard work are important. And I couldn't agree more with that. The problem is, what it's actually done to sports development is just completely flies in the face of what sports science says we should be doing.
David Epstein, The Sports Gene, now out on paperback, Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance. When you watch some of these guys, gals on television, or you're at an event, you say to yourself, boy, how did they get there? The way some guys get there and gals get there is really mind-boggling. Let's go into a couple of anecdotes in your book that really blew my mind. Let's start in the track world. Donald Thomas. That is a great story. Share the story of Donald Thomas.
So Donald was a student at a small college in Missouri, talking trash about how good an athlete he was one day at lunch. And the best high jumper on the track team was sitting nearby, a guy named Carlos, and overheard him and said, you know what, you don't even know what it means to be a real athlete. Like, you wouldn't even clear a bar of 6'6" if you had to be in a real competition. And Donald said, oh, yes, I would. So they start a bet. Donald goes home, gets his sneakers, his basketball shorts. Carlos sets up a bar at 6'6" in the field house, and Donald takes 5 steps and clears it. So they move it up to 6'8", which is Carlos's school record. Donald takes 7 steps, clears it. 6'10", Donald clears it. 7 feet, Donald clears it. And at that point, Carlos tells him to stop. He's worried he'll hurt himself. Takes him over to the coach, who quickly enters him in the next track meet, Donald's first track meet ever. Jumps about 7'5", breaks a field house record. Shortly thereafter, to put it in a nutshell, turns professional. And 8 months after his first high jump, he wins the world championship over a guy who had already been an Olympic champion and had been kind of like the Tiger Woods of high jump, like obsessed from the time that he was a child. And turned out that Donald, he was examined by scientists afterward, and it turned out that he was born with this incredibly long Achilles tendon, which is basically like a spring in the back of your leg that you use for jumping. So it was like a very big spring that helped rocket him into the air. And despite the fact that he won the world championship, he told me that he finds high jump kind of boring, which is not something I had ever heard from a world champion.
What does Donald Thomas teach us, do you feel like?
In the book, I sort of contrasted him to that other guy, that sort of Tiger Woods of high jump, a guy named Stephen Holm, who had spent 20 years working on high jumping, and it improved about 1 centimeter a year for 20 years. You know, in something that seems like you sort of either got it or you don't, he transformed himself into the ultimate got it. And so those two guys came through basically the extreme path of nature and nurture, right? So Stephen Holm spent 20 years hardening his Achilles tendon, that spring in the back of his leg. Donald Thomas was just born with a really big one. So those guys average about 10,000 hours of practice, because Donald had about zero and Stephen had about 20,000. So there's your 10,000-hour rule. It just doesn't tell you much about reality. What it tells you is that even in a very straightforward sport, two guys at the same level can get there in incredibly different ways. And while both of those guys are very extreme, it turns out that the Donald Thomas path, the sort of not finding the perfect fit sport for you right away and coming across it somewhat later, is actually more the norm than the Stephen Holm path, where the first thing you glom onto actually turns out to work. So I wanted it to show the real variation around this 10,000-hour rule, but also to lead into this idea that while both these guys are incredibly extreme, the Donald Thomas is not as extreme. You know, it's extreme to do it maybe that late and at that level in life, but that's actually the path that lots of elite athletes follow, where they've tried some different things and they sort of happen into what works if they spend time sort of sampling sports.
You know, I was talking to my wife, who's an athlete growing up, all-state basketball player, and played every sport. David, even at her age now, she still will do multiple things and enjoys a variety of different activities. And I was telling her about you're attacking the 10,000-hour rule in this book, and she's a golf freak. She said, you know, there's a guy who's adhering to the 10,000-hour rule, and he wants to be a professional golfer. And I said, yeah, and it's not really going too well. Can you give us an update on our friend who's working toward his PGA Tour card through the 10,000-hour rule?
Yeah, this is Dan McLaughlin, who was a commercial photographer and just sort of decided to drop everything after having read about the 10,000-hour rule and put in 10,000 hours of golf practice and see if he could become pro, having really never played before. Well, I'm happy to report that he loves the sport. I think he's really enjoying it, and I think it did lead to sort of some of the life changes he wanted, because he wanted to change his life. And he's a good golfer. I think he's at like a 6 handicap or something. So he's really good, but he's in a period sort of diminishing returns where he's not getting good that fast anymore. So I think if you evaluate it objectively at this point, you'd have to say it looks like he's not going to make it by 10,000 hours, but I'm thrilled that he's really enjoying the sport and is happy with the change that he made in his life.
Yeah, your book is, and there's so much great stuff in here. You're not afraid of controversy, though. I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but I'm just going to ask you if I read this right, okay? You make the point, or the book does, the science does. Black athletes, on average, do run faster. They do jump higher than their white counterparts. You make a point, though, that it's not for the reasons we think it is. It's got a lot more to do with latitude and also climate than it does skin shade. First of all, is that correct? And then if it is, I'd like you to elaborate on that.
That's right. Let me give you sort of an easy example here. So if you talk about, say, black athletes dominating running, in the book, I look at Jamaican sprinters who are West African descendants, as well as Kenyan runners who are on the other side of the country in East Africa, the other side of the continent, and they could not be more physiologically different in many ways. Right? They are the opposite ends of extreme of physiology. The fact that they're both dark skin is just because their low latitude protects them from equatorial sunlight. But to call, say, well, black athletes dominate running, well, who are you talking about? You're basically encompassing the extremes of physiology there. And to give an example of what you mentioned about latitude, think about the Kenyan runners. We think of Kenyans as being these great marathon runners. You go to Kenya, they think of the Kalenjin tribe as being great marathoners. The Kalenjin is one tiny minority tribe, makes up about 12% of the Kenyan population, but almost all of the top marathoners. To put their achievement in perspective, 17 American men have run faster than 2 hours and 10 minutes in the marathon, which is 4 minutes and 58 seconds per mile pace. 32 Kalenjin men did that last October alone, just to put it in perspective, from this minority tribe in this one town. And one thing they have, on average, is a certain physiological build where they have extremely long limbs proportional to their body, and those limbs are they get even thinner than is usual at the extremity. And that's because they have their ancestry at very low latitude. I was crisscrossing the equator when I was visiting them, in a very hot and dry climate, and an evolutionary adaptation to that is long, thin limbs that are very thin at the extremity for cooling purposes. The same reason that a radiator has long coils to increase the surface area compared to volume. And because the leg is like a pendulum, the less weight you have at the extremity, the longer it is and the thinner at the extremity, the more energy efficient it is to swing. So that's a perfect body type for running. It requires less oxygen to go at a certain speed. And it's an awful body type for swimming, because you want the exact opposite for swimming. You want a long torso and short legs. So here you have this group of people who, on average, have this particular body type because of their geographical ancestry that even other people in Kenya don't have, right? Just this specific group. You put them in this rural environment where they have this incredible motivation to try to use running to escape poverty, and you see what is the craziest overrepresentation of athletic skill I think the world has ever seen.
What's the reaction to that? As you've published that back in the late summer of 2013, what's the reaction been to that?
It's kind of funny because some of the sports scientists who have studied kind of the social context of the Kalenjin runners have felt like maybe I'm devaluing their hard work in some way by pointing to certain physiological traits. The physiologists who study it, they already know it's the case, so it's not a problem with them. But some of sort of the sociologists say, well, you're devaluing their hard work. And I say that's absolutely not the case. It doesn't devalue their hard work at all. No, just because you have talent, turning that into a gold medal or whatever is a whole different story, right? Like, I would never denigrate Michael Jordan's hard work just because he happens to be taller than 99% of the population, right? Like, we all have talents, and we should try to find them and capitalize on them. But I'll tell you where the least resistance has come from is the Kalenjin runners themselves. I think they kind of love it. I think they've almost internalized this feeling of being superior to their rivals, and even when in some cases where it might not be true, I think they find that to be kind of a psychological advantage.
I think it's wonderful that you would point it out as openly as you did and explain it as openly as you did. It's refreshing. Let's talk about these things, which is what you're doing. And by the way, this book, The Sports Gene, David Epstein is the guest. Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance, from Current Books. David, on the way out here, I thank you for this. I thank you for appearing with me today. I thank you for your time. This is not a subject that's going to go away anytime soon. Will you do some more digging on this as we go along?
I think that's very likely. I'm going to recover from this book a little bit, but my interest in these issues certainly hasn't dulled, and now I sort of know the landscape and where the cutting-edge research is going on, so I think the answer to that is yes.
Second question for you on the way out. Do youth sports change? Do we see a sea change in this country? Or do the amount of academies, the amount of over-specialization, hyper-specialization, as you called it earlier, does that continue to proliferate in our society?
I think it continues for a little while. I think maybe there will start to be, as some of these issues, like the prevalence of Tommy John surgery this season at the major league level, as people start talking about how that has nothing to do with the major league level and has everything to do with the youth level, I think we'll start to decelerate the trend. I don't think we'll start to reverse it yet, but I do think it will start to decelerate. And I don't think a health message for kids is enough, sadly. But I think as this science is building, showing that this isn't even the best way to develop sports skill, that science is building like crazy right now. I think it is going to start to decelerate it, because this year when I've gone around to sort of conferences of sports scientists, they're now acutely aware of this issue, and I think sort of organizing in ways to kind of take it on and start to make a difference.
Hey, David, on the way out here, I'd like you to have a final word, maybe anything we haven't touched on that you'd like to, or if you want to reiterate a point, but please, I appreciate your appearance. Go ahead.
Well, I would just say that one of the major things that came out of the book for me was to be sort of startled at how much scientists have learned about how truly different we each are at the genetic level. I mean, learning things that people have wondered about since we've been wondering about our own nature, basically. And just like the revolution that came out of medical genetics is that because of differences in our genes, there's no perfect medication regimen for any two people that's the same. Same thing is showing up for the medicine of training. There's no two people who respond to any particular training the same way. So the challenge of taking on training or developing a skill is to find that environment that's optimal for your completely unique biology. And the way to start doing that is to take a trial and error approach to yourself when you train. And I think that's the mindset we should all enter training with.
David, thank you again. Great, great talking with you.
Thanks very much for having me.
Hey, thanks again, man.